Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Rewatchable. We are up to episode 124, and we are starting The Legend of Korra Book 3, Change, episodes 1 and 2, A Breath of Fresh Air and Rebirth. So, going into a new season of Legend of Korra after last week's finale of Harmonic Convergence antics. And this week, I am your host, Natalie, and we have a whole new team with me this week compared to who was on last week. So a whole switch around except for me. So sorry if you're sick of me, but you've got everyone else here who's cool to make up for it. If you want to get in touch with anyone on the podcast about our upcoming episodes, no spoilers, please, for the newbies or any of the past episodes, you can contact us on rewatchable.podcast@gmail.com. You can comment on our Twitter, re_watchable. This post on hyperball.com, where we host the podcast, you can leave comments there. And our Tumblr is rewatchablepodcast.tumblr.com. So that is how you can get in touch with us if you have anything to say, if you have anything you'd like us to read out on an episode, or some feedback about our opinions and all of that kind of thing. So, going in, I am your host this week, Natalie, and I'm a super fan. And this week we've actually got a super fan heavy episode. We've got three super fans versus one newbie, which is an unusual balance, but it's just the way the cookie crumbles. And so it's myself. We have Caitlin, who's a super fan. We have Donya, who's a super fan, and we have Karen, who's a newbie, and she's very excited to talk about this episode. So we'll just do some fun facts, our little game that we have installed, just in case anyone is confused by voices, especially the person who in the past has said they can't tell me and Donya apart, aside from me being Australian and her being Welsh.
Wait,
So what?
what? Are you serious? The two of us, really?
And so, it happens. So let's all go around. Does anyone have a fun fact pre-prepared, or may I select a theme?
I have one pre-prepared.
Okay, Karen, why don't you go first, and then we'll go after you. So say your name.
I am Karen. And I just bought a t-shirt that has Willow on it, and it says "Bored now," because that's one of my favorite lines from Buffy, and I got it today, and I'm very excited.
Oh, that's good. That's a nice fun fact. Does anyone else have a fun fact? The other because we can go with the theme of most recently purchased item, or we can just have random facts.
Most recently purchased item will probably have you guys judging me.
Well, go ahead. Say
I
your
bought
name to the
one.
nice people and then tell them about it.
I'm Danya, and I bought one of those BB-8 droids that you can make.
Yes, they look so cool. Guys, I don't even like Star Wars and I want
Yeah, I'm really glad that I don't care about Star Wars because I would be panicking about like all of this, whatever's going on with it right now. But I'm just like, oh, something's happening with Star Wars. That's nice, I guess,
It
at
was
the moment.
essentially all it was them dropping every single piece of merchandise for the upcoming movie on one day. That's what happened. So it led to like loads of ridiculous crowds outside of stores with people like trying to get in to buy figures and Lego and all sorts of stuff, except I was a fairly sensible person and I just bought what I wanted online. So yeah, and all I bought was that little droid, and I'm waiting for it to get here so I can like drive it around the house. Apparently it makes noises and it has lights and it's really cute. And people had
Sounds
them with
stressful.
puppies.
Caitlin, how about you?
My most recently purchased item was the Peggy Carter Funko, and she's sitting on my desk looking awesome with
Aww.
my Sarah Lance and Buffy Funkos, because I got my girls on one side and my guys on the other side of my desk.
Segregation.
All right, well, I'll go last, even though you've already heard me speak and you probably know my voice by now. So I'm Natalie, your host, and my most recently purchased item was, well, online and in person, it's very different. My most recently purchased item was yesterday afternoon. I went and I bought a new set of sheets for my bed that match the curtains in my room because I'm an old lady, basically. and they're like vintage floral, so it's not they're not cool, like they're really old, like, you know. That's some like A plus adulting, and they cost like over $100. Like, it's like A plus adulting. But my most recent online purchase was the Raven Cycle set of tarot cards that the author has drawn, because tarot is sort of a big part of the books, and she has drawn up a set of Raven themed tarot cards and written a handbook about understanding tarot, and I ordered that online from a local store in Virginia where she's from, and getting it sent to our other friend Brooke in Virginia because I want the special edition that's only coming from that store. So that's a bit more cool than sheets. So we'll move on now from that, I suppose.
I don't know. I kind of do like floral prints, so
just send you a photo later. Yeah, Donya only has floral shirts, I think, and hawkeye.
No, it's skirts. It's mostly skirts.
All right, going into chapter one of book three, A Breath of Fresh Air, synopsis. Who made the doc this week? Did they both write in this?
Mitch made it, and I think Ariana, like, added to it.
Okay. So in this episode, Cora messed up everything by keeping the spirit portals open. Spirit vines are destroying Republic City, but that's okay, guys. The spirits are here so we can get along with them, and it's not like they have an entire designated universe to themselves already or something. Late-blooming airbenders are cropping up all around the world, including Boomy, and nobody knows why, but it probably had something to do with Cora's horrible decision-making. Hashtag Cora now thinks Unalaq was right. President Ryko has enough of the aftermath of Korra's actions and demands the Avatar leave the city immediately. Tenzin and a few of the crew decide to go round up the new airbenders to rebuild the long-dead Air Nation. A new airbender named Zahia escapes his high-security prison, stating that the age of the White Lotus is over. So, pretty big and immediate jump into Season 3. Like, they ain't pulling punches here. They are right into the changes from Harmonic Convergence, and the biggest changes, obviously, the spirits taking over the world, you know, and the fact that these new airbenders can pop up, the most exciting to us being, you know, Aang's non-bender son, Boomy, is suddenly an airbender. So how do we feel about that revelation as the first big major thing that we care about? Karen, everyone else is like, yeah, we were waiting for this. So Karen, I'll probably be directing a lot of questions to you first because we want your astounded reactions.
Okay. First of all, let me say that Season 3 has already proven to be super incredible for a lot of different reasons. And I liked Season 2, but jumping into Season 3, it made me realize how, like, good Season 1 was and how Season 2 kind of went down a little bit. So I'm already super excited about these first two episodes. But with that out of the way, I'm excited that Boomy can airbend because I think it's really cool. But at the same time, I kind of liked that he wasn't a bender and that he didn't need to be a bender in order to, like, contribute to the team.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's fair, and that we've always, you know, had that kind of issue with the way that people treat non-benders and them proving themselves. But he was so excited by it.
Yeah, it was really cute.
So any theories on why people can airbend now, I suppose?
I wonder if it has something to do with the spirits because, well, no, they got their powers before from the turtle thingies. What are they? Turtle lions. I almost said turtle ducks. Lion turtles. Yeah, I knew I got that wrong. So I thought at first maybe it had to do with the spirits, but maybe not. I don't know. It must be something about balance and just wanting to balance the four elements again.
That could be true. And there's obviously they pop up in all different nations. It's not just like, oh, Aang's non-airbender kid is now not a is now a bender. But Caitlin, I wanted to ask, how do you feel about I haven't had you on a lot of episodes where we've discussed like what we know about Aang kind of as a father and how he, treated Tenzin and how he treated the others. So how do you feel about what this means for kind of Bumi and dead Aang's relationship, or how Aang would have reacted to Bumi and then just, would have he just tossed Kaya out the window or something like that?
Oh, poor Kaya. Well, she had her mother. It's kind of bittersweet in that sense, because we do get the sense, at least from the perspective of his kids, that he focused on Tenzin for understandable reasons, but maybe to the exclusion of the others. So had Bumi had this growing up, he probably would have gotten a lot more attention. And who knows what kind of character he would have turned into, because he probably developed this over-the-top personality to compensate for not getting the attention his other siblings got for being benders. So it's interesting to think about, but he probably would have gotten a lot more attention from Aang, and he probably would be a very different character. So in that way, it's very bittersweet that it comes to him so much later in life that he can't enjoy that aspect of it.
Yeah, like I like what Karen said, like I think that it's good that he was a non-bender, for the development of his character. I don't mind him having the bending now, in terms of him being non-bender and what that means for who he is, I think it's very different. It's kind of like the difference between being like people who are born rich and people who get money late in life, if you know what I mean. Like people who are born into money and never think about what it means to be like that, versus people who become very wealthy late in life and some people act crazy about it, but some people, they never really act like rich people, if you know what I mean. They just happen to have money, and it's because of the attitude of, anyway, that's just a small metaphor that I was musing over. Katara, obviously we don't see Katara's reaction to this, but she's mentioned a couple of times, like Bumi says, Mom's gonna love this and all of that kind of stuff. So we have some theories here that this implies that Katara further instigated the Aang's obsession over his airbending child and promoting Tenzin as the most important and special. I don't know if that's quite accurate, but do you think that like Bumi was always going to be a surefire hit for the airbending genes to come and get him, because he is actually Aang's kid? And does this mean that it's more proof that Kaya might be a product of hashtag Zutara, because she's Fire Nation sexy and she inherited Katara's bending? Donya, theories, thoughts?
Oh my god. That is probably, oh my god, I can't get my head around that theory for a second.
Have you guys never talked about that before? We talk about that literally all the time. Mitch, like seriously, like that Kaya is a Zutara child is like a common form of conversation with Team Mitch. Like it's like terrible. But yeah, anyway,
This is only the third episode that I've been on. I haven't actually been on any episodes with Mitch this time round, which is kind of sad, but I don't know. I don't necessarily believe that Katara would have promoted one of the kids over the other. I think she probably would have been the way that she was through Avatar, the most level-headed. I don't see that she would have treated any of her children differently. I mean, I got the feeling through the first two seasons that, and especially when we're introduced to Kaya and Bumi, the Katara seems to, you know, love them all equally, or at least given her attentions equally. So I'm not sure.
Yeah. No, I agree. In theory, I agree with you, but yeah, I don't know. Kaya, the waterbender, obviously now two airbenders. Ariana has just wanted to offer her thoughts to us through the form of taking over the dock, saying, Mitchell is obviously trying to round up the haters. But in all seriousness, I get emotional thinking about Bumi airbending. How precious were the kids who were like, maybe he's just a late bloomer. And then when Tenzo was like, nobody wants to join my club, Bumi was like, hey, it's okay, little bro. I still want to join your club. I think it's really nice. Like, I think it's, there's going to be a lot of discussion, I think, in a moment about culture, like the culture of the air nomads and the... whether you want to call it a race or a religion, like it's sort of a halfway between the two of those things. It's not just a skill. For Tenzin, it's not just a skill. It is a, it's a culture which no one else is a part of. And they've started their little, air fan club, what are they called? The air acolytes or whatever. So he's kind of, converting some people to the way of life. But he's very hung up on this idea of, that airbending means you are automatically a part of that culture. And whether that is right or wrong is something I want to debate. But he is so sad about it. And Bumi, as a non-bender in a family with two very distinct cultures, like Southern Water Tribe and their traditions and Air Nomad, Aang trying to rebuild the Air Nomads with just Tenzin. Bumi never really had a culture. Not only did he not have bending, he was like a classic product of like a mixed race family where he didn't fit in with either race and never felt comfortable. So it is kind of cute that he has something that he identifies with that he wants to identify with, I suppose.
It makes sense in that context that he would go into a military life because that would give him that identifying marker.
For sure.
Thing to identify with.
Not just because he was put in a potato sack and
no matter what he says.
Okay. So Tenzin and his feelings about the situation, basically. We'll move on to that because it is actually a big part of the episode. Is Tenzin being so happy and excited to hear about these new airbenders and what it means for him. Do you think that he has any kind of, at this point, like, delusions about what it means that there are new airbenders? Or do you, like, his excitement is warranted and it's nice that he's, like, happy about it and not like, oh, these people aren't real airbenders, they're not pure airbenders or whatever. They're basically, like, muggle-born airbenders is what they are, which is cool. But, and he doesn't have any, any snobbish air nomad elitism about that, which is nice. Think that he was maybe not thinking far ahead enough about what it means, about what his grand ideas, would mean for these people that aren't actually from the Air Nomad culture. Like, Karen, how did you feel about Tenzin's sort of initial reactions to this discovery?
Tenzin was really intense about everything.
He always is.
Yeah, that's true. But this was like a step beyond, I think. He was really intense about it. But I don't blame him for it. I love the fact that he was so excited that there were other airbenders. And you're right that it wasn't like, oh, they're not good enough. They're not pure, airbenders or whatever. So that was really cool. And I like the fact that he didn't necessarily, and I don't think Tenzin would do this anyway, but it wasn't like, oh yes, we have more people to fight as airbenders now or, something like that. It was like, I want to share the culture of my people with these other people who don't know anything about it. And he was really excited just to like talk to them and share with them those experiences and that sort of like the spiritual side of being an airbender, which is very Tenzin. It wasn't out of character at all, but I thought that was really nice that he thought of it that way. But yeah, very intense.
Yeah, I love him. So moving on from the airbender situation. Oh, and by the way, I really liked I really liked the moment in the second airbender that they found, the fact that he destroyed his own shop. Like, I loved that he was just being like, sorry, rather than like, I loved the whole portrayal of the second, like the non-boomy airbender guy, and how he was freaking out. I really enjoyed that. And Tenzin's meeting with him, I love Tenzin's whole deal, but I think that he has some delusions and problems when it comes to this circumstance. But going on to the actual spirit portal problem, so massive spirit vines have taken over the city. Spirits are just randomly like living in places. Cora is like trying to fix/remove it, but she's still kind of determined that the spirit portals are open and everyone just has to get used to it and deal with it now. So bad choice? I don't know. Donya, how do you feel about this decision to honor Unalaq's wishes and keep the spirit portals open?
I mean, we saw Cora struggling with the whole thing and whether or not she should or shouldn't do it. And after the whole seeing her origins as the Avatar and learning all of that and learning all about the history and what happened with the spirits and when spirits and humans were like living together. Like it was ultimately her decision, you know, and I will still stand by the fact that she's a really strong character for standing by her convictions that this was the right idea and the thing that she wanted to do. And I mean, obviously, one way or the other, she was going to face some kind of backlash, either for the rampant destruction that happened because of Unalaq, or for what she's facing now, which is that she's kept the spirit portals open. So, honestly, that she's standing by her convictions makes her that much stronger a character for me and makes me like her more. So,
It's a stupid-ass decision, and I've elected to ignore it, just saying. Well, it is. I don't know. Caitlin, do you think that it was a bad choice or a good choice? Because I feel like, you know, she could have closed them off. They would have had to, yes, clean up after the Unalaq damage, but then we would have been okay. And, you know, even Avatar 1 decided that the spirits needed to go back in the spirit world, and Unalaq, the evil, like, weird religious crazy dude, was like, yes, it needs to be free and open. Like, I don't understand how she came out of this whole circumstance with maybe Unalaq had a point.
Well, I don't think that at the end of the day, Unalaq's goal was just to have the spirits come into the world. His goal was to get Vatu so he could become the Dark Avatar. So he really wasn't interested in all that. I don't think that he was spouting about bringing balance with the spirits and the humans. I think that was a cover for what he was really after. So I don't really see an issue with her taking the idea of having the portals open being his idea, because that really was not what he was after. But I kind of think it's a good idea, because we had 10,000 years where it was one way, and we saw a number of issues with it being that way. So, and when there's particular imbalance, we were seeing the issues of the dark spirits and things coming. So maybe things should go to how they were, how we see that they were kind of originally meant to be, because the world, as far as we know, started out with both spirits and humans in the same place. So maybe this time, now that we know more as humans, we can find that balance. I don't blame Cora for making that decision.
Oh, you guys are all a lot more peaceful about this than the other half of this podcast, I must say, and we just want to talk quickly about Janora as well, because we've had a lot of discussion with the other group in recent weeks about whether, you know, obviously you can't choose who the avatar is, but whether Janora would have made a better avatar than Korra. Is that something you guys have thought about? Like, Karen, I haven't been on with you as a newbie for a while. How do you feel about my magical princess Janora? How do you feel about her sort of take on the world and whether she would have been a good person in this position, basically?
I think I talked about this last time I was on, but maybe it was with Michal. I don't think that Janora would have necessarily been a better avatar than Korra. I don't think that Korra is a better avatar than Janora could be. I think it just depends on the person, and I think everybody has their own path to walk. And, you know, even if Janora became the avatar, she isn't going to be perfect. Everybody has their strengths and weaknesses. And while she's, you know, very spiritual, maybe she wouldn't have had the ability to stand up and fight as much as Korra has. So everybody's always going to have their own issues to work through. I think Janora would have been a fine avatar, but I don't think that Korra's a bad avatar either. I think she just has a lot to learn, and luckily she is learning.
There was the interesting conversation between Korra and Tenzin about, you know, that whole their whole little thing where Bolin comes and interrupts, and you know, Tenzin saying that Korra's ushered in a new age, and Korra says avatar wisdom is a thing of the past, and I was a bit confused by what that could mean, like whether it's meant to be that the avatar is just the powers now, like she's actually like that the avatar will never again meant to be this like judging, like I know about the balance, I know what is going to be right or wrong, which seems like a cop out. It kind of seems like a big part of the job description has gone down the drain, if you know what it means. So what do you think she meant by that, basically? You know, and what do you think that the avatar is going to stand for from here on out? Like, I don't know, Donya or Caitlin, is this something you've ever kind of thought about?
And I thought she was just making a joke, so I didn't actually take that line seriously.
Oh, I did.
Same, Caitlin. I thought it was just like a throwaway type of thing.
I don't know. I feel like that what the Avatar stands for now is something, you know, is quite different. Maybe it'll be different with whoever comes next in their personality, but given that she has no connection to the past, like she's got no, you know, no ability to kind of be like, I'm gonna look back through all of human history and be able to, like, you know, figure out how stuff is best. She's literally just a person with a bunch of powers now. Like, it's she doesn't have anything intrinsic to her that gives her any more right than anyone else to have an opinion on something, basically, which isn't a good or a bad thing. Like, it's kind of like what the guy says in the next episode, which I love, where he's like, no one says you have to do this. And it's like, can you imagine if the Avatar was just like, I'm not going to do that anymore. And I feel like there's more freedom for her to do that now, or for any Avatar to just be like, I don't really want to do that without the past lives connection, because it's just, she's just a superpowered bender, basically. She doesn't have any aspect of her that gives her the knowledge or the history or any perspective other than just whoever she happens to be at that time to help make the world make judgments. So do you think that there's a difference there in between, you know, what the Avatar used to be and now what it is without the past lives connection in the Avatar's responsibilities? I don't know, Donya?
I mean, where Korra is right now is essentially on equal footing with Wan. So she's essentially starting from the beginning all over again. Yeah. She is the start of the Avatar cycle. So it doesn't... I don't know. Wan isn't any less of an Avatar because he didn't have anyone come before him than Korra is for not having that connection with all of her past lives. So for me, it's kind of just like, well, she now has to make the Avatar work for herself. Now, whether that means that she builds on that wisdom and she doesn't act superior and act higher than other people because she doesn't have that knowledge anymore. She can't go back and ask for support or guidance from her past lives. You know, that's kind of the way that I see it, is that she's going to have to relearn everything from hundreds and hundreds of years worth of people being the Avatar. She's right back at square one. So she has to build all of that wisdom from the ground up on her own. So I don't necessarily think it may have been a throwaway line. It may have been a joke, but for me, it kind of could also be seen as, well, she's just going to have to learn all of that on her own again. So for now, she's not going to impose herself as someone higher than anyone else. She's just going to have to learn that for herself going forward. Mm.
Yeah. And do you guys sort of see a big change in her from season 2 to 3? Because some of the newbies were not massive fans of Korra and her personality. Ariana would like to note that she feels Korra is much improved this season and she really likes her now. Karen, do you feel a difference in her personality, like, as well, and her handling of things and just the way that she acts?
I felt a change once she lost her memories. I feel like on the flip side of that, she came out much more balanced and much more cautious. She wasn't one to quite run into the fights as quickly as she did before. She kind of like held back, thought about it, really tried to think about what was best for everyone. And that's continued into season 3 for me. So, I definitely see a difference. I think it happened a little bit sooner than just the beginning of season 3.
Yeah, I felt like she took a few steps backwards towards the end of season 2. But I do feel like she's definitely a lot more, likable, at least in my terms of likable, in season 3 onwards. So that will hopefully be good for the other newbies as well. But one of the things that is much improved in this season is Korra and Asami's friendship, because, you know, we've had a lot of Korra with the boys in the last couple of last season. Asami just kept, she's kind of there, but she kept just being like given weird tasks to do, like, oh yeah, I'll go somewhere else and sort something out, and then she comes back and she's like, I did that thing. Like, this season she's actually more present with the group because she's living, she's hanging out with Korra a lot more. Her and Bolin and Korra are hanging out a lot more, and Marco's like being an awkward turtle, like in the police station, because he feels awkward like living with Korra on Airbender Island. And this is a lot of fun. Korra and Asami hanging out, Asami teaching Korra how to drive, which I just loved. And their conversation about Marco and basically the way they react every time Marco has to talk to the two of them, which is hysterical because he's so awkward and they pretend that they're being harsh to him and then laugh at him behind his back, which is just glorious. So, Caitlin, yeah, how do you feel about sort of the reintroduction of Asami as a main character?
So happy. I love Asami so much, and it's so nice to see her coming back to the forefront and actually giving her something to do. We saw hints of the potential for the friendship between Korra and Asami back, especially in the first season. And now it's nice to start to see that bloom again. And they just have really good personalities to mesh with each other and be supportive. And I think that'll be good for Korra to have that female friend that's her age to be a sounding board to bounce off of her. Because
yeah,
she has other women in her life, but they tend to be either much older or much younger. So having that who's at her age, I think, is going to be really good for her.
Yeah. One of the aspects of this season, I mean, all of Korra, but especially noticeable in book 3 onwards, is there are a few moments of various episodes that literally feel like watching a real, like a filmed television show. Like, they feel like the body language and just everything and the conversations, the tone, the pauses, it almost doesn't feel animated. It feels like you're watching real actors. And the car conversation between Asami and Korra is one of them to me. And I really, really enjoyed that. Karen, how did you like that? Their kind of handling of Marco, basically.
It was perfect. I don't think I would have wanted it any other way, because they talked about it, for one. Like, they admitted everything that happened, and they were kind of like, yeah, okay, that was fine, that happened, it's a thing of the past, now we can just kind of sit here and look at it. And they're both stronger because of that, I think. It's not necessarily them, like, relying on Mako to be the people that they are, always going back to, well, when I was with Mako, you know, I was this way. It was like, yeah, we were both with Mako, and it's over now, and now we can be friends. And it's so refreshing, because on television, you don't tend to get that. You always get the cattiness between the girls when, you know, they're fighting over a boy. And it was nice for them to just, like, lay everything out and kind of turn to each other and be like, yeah, I'm cool with that. Want to be friends? Okay.
Did you get scared at any moment in that conversation, whether, you know, when they were both like, oh, I kissed him while I was with you? The second one, when Cora was like, oh, yeah, I kissed him when you guys were going out, Asami's reaction, did you think she was faking it out, or did you think it was like, oh, they're going to actually have a fight now?
I was a little nervous, just because I was like, oh my God, they're so, like, amazing. I love them as friends. And then she said that, and I was like, oh God, what if this ruins everything? But then it was totally fine, so I was super happy.
And how do we feel about Marco's behavior? Because Mitch is really trying to make out like Mako is being terrible, and he's actually not being that bad. He's just super awkward and stilted and doesn't know how to talk or exist, and I find that quite cute, actually. So, Donya, how are you about Mako and Bolin at the moment as well? What about the boys this season so far?
I love the boys in this season, and especially in these two episodes. I don't think that Marco's reactions are completely abnormal. Yeah. I mean, he's having to interact with the two women last season that he dated, or kind of was dating, and then was covering up that he was dating the other. Like, that's awkward. That's seriously awkward, you know? And that he's having to be faced with them so soon after that, and he's trying to, like, hold a normal conversation with both of them, and it's just, it's adorable. It's really, really, really endearing for me, so I don't think there's anything weird about it. I thought it was a very natural reaction to being faced by two of your exes that either you're not entirely over in the first place, and also having to, you know, work with them on some pretty serious stuff that's happening. So yeah, that's how I feel, and I love Bolin anyway.
I was gonna say, this is the most that I've liked Mako since his introductory episode.
Mm-hmm. What's funny to me is it's all on him. Both of the girls are just like, whatever, and, like, you know, and are pretending to make it awkward for him. Mm-hmm. But they're both chill, and to be fair, he does have reason to believe that Cora would be unchill, because she has been insane in the past and reactionary and terrible. He does have precedence to feel anxious. However, I find it hilarious that, like, the awkwardness is just him. Like, they're both like, yeah, whatever. But yeah, Caitlin, do you think he could be reacting any better, or do you think this is good?
I think this is the most endearing reaction he could have, because,
yeah,
you know, he's set up when he's first introduced to be that suave, yeah, dark and brooding character, and you're like, you think you know the type, and then he just gets increasingly awkward as the series moves on, and just the more awkward he gets, the more he's likable, I think.
Yeah, no, I agree.
He has some humility, which he hasn't had at all, and it's nice to see that side of him.
Yeah. I love him in this, and I love him in the next episode as well. It's just, he's just... It's like, you know, you're all Teen Wolf people to a degree here, and it's like the progress from, or at least fandom's interpretation of the progress of Derek from, you know, actual oh dark, God, brooding, yes, person to, like, nerd who's winging it the whole time and is actually super socially awkward. So yeah, it's very much like that kind of arc of character, and I enjoy it hugely. But before we move on to the next episode where such hilarious things happen, The spirit vines, that whole situation of them taking over the world, basically. Cora is, you know, trying to solve this problem, and she somehow gets inspired to remove the vines with the spirit bending of water, and it kind of works for a second, then it doesn't work, and they come back even stronger. Caitlin and Donya, was this ever explained, like, why she got this idea or why she thought this would work or how the spirit bending works at all?
Yeah, because when they ran into that spirit coming out of the vines, it says we're one and the same. So she goes, oh, the way to get rid of spirits is,
well, to be nice to them.
Well, it's to do that, like, release bending thing that she did. So realizing that the vines themselves are part spirit, I think, is what gave her the idea. And she didn't maybe realize that before.
Oh, right. Okay. I thought she did realize that. I've missed a step there. No problem. That's fine. And obviously the big issue, you know, that she, you know, the mayor or whatever it is, the president keeps coming along to be like, look at Avatar Korra failing all over the spot. And he doesn't take any responsibility for the destruction of Republic City, even though Korra asked for help to avoid this happening several times. How do we feel about kind of that whole, like, the government and the press versus Korra, basically, the way that they were kind of all over her everywhere she went, and how she was being blamed for everything, basically. Like, you know, she was being blamed by the drama about the new airbender. You know, she was being blamed for, obviously, the spirits, which was technically her fault, but it's all part of a long process. So do you think Raiko is taking no responsibility, or do you think that he, you know, do you think he's privately sitting in his mansion being like, shit, this wouldn't have happened if I'd sent the damn fleets to help her kill Unalaq? Or do you think that he is actually, you know, righteous, I guess? Karen, how do you react about this kind of real world, quote unquote, real world, like, you know, government stuff, like the press, the approval ratings and all of that kind of things?
That was really interesting to me, especially since right now things are kind of kicking off with the 2016 presidential election and ratings are in the news all the time. And I was like, wow, this is super relevant. It was interesting. It was almost a little too real for me, but I can see what they're doing, and I appreciated it. I'm also very angry at myself for ever defending Raiko and thinking that he was a good dude who had a hard decision to make, because maybe he did before, but now he's just being a jerk about it, and I think that he's definitely just trying to save face. I mean, if he can blame everything on Korra and make her look as bad as possible, then people aren't going to look his way and realize that he's not really doing anything either.
Yeah, I think that it's true that he, as I said, like, you know, he should have helped. I mean, if he'd helped originally, he might not have such a big problem on his hands now. But, you know, politicians, man, what are you gonna do? How do you guys feel about the kind of, I mean, someone who's written the doc, either Mitch or Ariane, has, like, written, we have approval ratings in this world, ? Because the Atlas series was so pastoral, like, they had, like, you know, kings and stuff, they had, like, vague forms of government, but not anything that reflected, like, real life today. It was, like, a pastoral, you know, pre-industrial revolution society, you know, and now there's a lot more that reflects, you know, contemporary, you know, 20th century society, you know, with some stuff that is completely present day, like, you know, pro sports, and some stuff that's, you know, the technology is sort of, you know, 1930s-ish era. Donya and Caitlin, when you first watched the show, like, did you find that jump in the world building too much for you, or do you like the difference, basically? Because we've also theorized about what, like, an Avatar would be like in the future, like in a world which is totally futuristic, like, you know, 100 years down the line for them, or 500 years down the line for them, where it's still the Avatar world with bending, but in a society, you know, even more, you know, representing ours, basically. So, Donya, how do you feel about that change in society and the way that they kind of talk about things, you know, the tech they have, like driving the radio approval ratings and the reflection of real life society?
I mean, I like it because it helps to differentiate the two series. So it helps to split them apart from Avatar The Last Airbender and Legend of Korra more than just the characters. And I don't know, it didn't feel so strange to me. I kind of enjoyed it, especially because a lot of it just like harks back to World War II era, and I've always kind of dug stuff set in that kind of time period anyway, so the kind of parallels that it draws with a lot of that is something that I really enjoy anyway. So for me, it wasn't too strange, but I don't know, maybe I'm alone in that.
Caitlin, how did you like it?
I like it. It doesn't bother me at all. I mean, I think in some ways, like Donya's saying, it helps differentiate, but also I think it takes in mind that the audience that was younger watching Avatar has grown up a little bit, and now they're presenting issues that make a little more sense for a little bit older of an audience, because younger kids may not have quite the sense of what, you know, political machinations and approval ratings and all that kind of stuff entails. Whereas now that we're older and we're watching it now, they understand we're going to get that sort of thing and recognize the underhanded things that are going on a little more. So I think it also adds into a little more grown-up feel of it.
Yeah, I kind of like it, but it certainly wasn't what I was expecting going into the show back when it came out, basically. Okay, so Raiko kicks Korra out of the city, basically bans her from the city, and she was kind of like, good, I was going anyway, and now she's going off around the world to find the new airbenders in a journey that is a little bit reminiscent of the first, you know, Team Avatar journeying around the world on a task. So was this an exciting moment, you know, to do it, basically? Is this an exciting moment for the show to get to, or would have you been happy for it to stay kind of more centrally located, you know, like it has been the whole time? Like, Karen, were you excited for the banishment road trip?
Actually, I was a little worried at first, because when she was like, fine, I'm leaving anyway, I thought Tenzin would have stopped her, would have been like, you can't abandon your duties. And he was like, well, I'm going with you. And that was kind of cool. I was happy that he approved, but it did sort of feel like she was turning her back on the city, which I wasn't sure how I felt about that. But that being said, I'm really happy that we're going to be exploring more of the world now, because that's one of the biggest things I miss from Avatar, is that they got to see all these different places and run into all these different people and have all these different situations that they had to deal with and overcome. And while we had plenty of situations that Korra had to overcome prior to this, it was all very centrally located, and I'm just excited to like go out and meet other people who might live in the countryside and might have different ideas and kind of test Korra and how she views the world.
What kind of things do you expect her to, given Aang's road trip and all of the things that he faced, what kind of things do you predict / expect to shock and surprise and challenge her the most?
I don't know if I have anything specific in mind right now. I mean, it's a different world than what we saw with Aang. I think that in Avatar, a lot of their challenges came from the Fire Nation, and the Fire Nation people not necessarily being as inherently bad as they had initially thought. I don't think Korra has to overcome that sort of thing anymore, because it's a much more blended civilization now. I'm still interested in exploring the idea of spirits living with people. And while I think Korra is okay with what she's done, I mean, she has her doubts, but it was her decision to keep the portals open. I'll be interested to see how other people are dealing with it.
Yeah. What, you know, because obviously they've mentioned a few places that, you know, we obviously been to before, like Ba Sing Se and stuff like that. Republic City is a new location. But, you know, other places that we've seen before, like, you know, Northern Water Tribe, we've been there before, Ba Sing Se, obviously the Fire Nation, you know, how they're affected by the spirits or how they've changed in the last 70 years as well. Like, so, you know, I hope you're excited to see some old familiar places. All right, we'll go on to the main point of this. I suppose, Donya and Caitlin, before we go on, does anyone want to give any one sentence spoiler slash hint slash trigger word for that the super fans will understand, but that the newbies you know can get excited over about what we can expect from the road trip or this journey around the world?
Oh God.
I'm really nervous now.
I'm drawing a blank.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of something that won't ruin things. I can't think of something that won't spoil things.
Just one word. Can you think of a one word thing?
Red.
Pardon?
Red.
Okay. Mine will be Beifong.
Oh. No, Natalie's is the best one. No, I can't think of... No, I'm drawing a blank. I can't think of anything that wouldn't spoil things, and I don't want to...
You don't want to
I really, really don't want to spoil things. I don't want to turn into Mitch. It's not
right. Okay, we'll move on. We'll move on from this. That's fine. But you, yes, things that have come. So the you know, one thing that we've talked about quite a bit on the show before, on various episodes, is like what it intrinsically means to be a certain bender, like, you know, what kind of temperament, what kind of personality you have, you know, could there be an avatar who's a bad guy, like whose spirit is naturally a bad person, you know, not Una Avatar, like the real avatar that's like a bad guy, would it not choose someone, you know, do the air nomads all, are they all like intrinsically like, you know, peaceful, or is it just like a culture that's forced upon them when they have that bending? You know, that question is slightly addressed here, is, you know, one of it doesn't seem like that airbending was too discriminatory about who it chose to be a new bender, because it has chosen Zaheer, one of the biggest criminals in the world, basically. And he is unleashed. He gets the power of bending, sort of instantly knows how to channel it, and manages to escape this very, very high tech solo prison that he's being kept in, guarded by the White Lotus. Which is really interesting, because the White Lotus, obviously, you know, all we've known about them in the past is they're originally secret society, you know, force for balance, you know, helping the Avatar, etc. You know, all of these cool people from all different nations are in it. And you know, they help train the new Avatar, they help train Korra. And so we've got Zaheer in a prison by the White Lotus. He manages to take them out quite easily. And then, you know, in the next episode, we see quite a bit more about Zaheer. First thing I'd like to say about Zaheer, which no one has put in the doc, is that his voice actor is an incredible, very famous, very influential punk rock musician called Henry Rollins, who is the singer of Black Flag. I really don't think that that's our target market here with Avatar, but Henry Rollins was a massive fan of the show and got this voice role, basically, and it's ridiculous that he is voicing a children's cartoon, because he's, like, you know, just this really, like, famous, like, he's, like, old, like, 40 or 50 now, but, like, social kind of justice punk... He did writing and slam poetry and stuff as well. So it's really interesting that he is the voice actor for this character. And it's if anyone else out there at all cares about that, come and talk to me. But Zaheer. So first of all, you know, airbending has picked a pretty nasty guy to be inside of. So do you think that What do you think that kind of means for how airbending selected people? Do you think it was totally random, or you know, that, you know, is there some reason why certain people got the bending? Donya, do you feel like it's just literally random who it hit?
I think it was random. I don't think that there's any way for it to know one way or the other, like, what kind of person they are before they get that power. It could potentially also just be a compatibility thing, like certain people in and the way that maybe they can move and channel things. It's that's how it works, in the, like, I guess it's their physical body rather than their mind, and whether they are capable of being able to channel that power without damaging or hurting themselves. Because you see Zaheer, like, from the get-go is very adept at being able to channel airbending, and yeah, you can see the fluidity in his movements just in general. So he's very, very trained just in his movements in general. So it's either completely random, or I think it's something to do with their physical body rather than their mind. Because if you think about it, when you're born with that power, how would they know one way or the other how your
spirit,
how your spirit's going to turn out? I mean, a lot of who you are as a person will come down to your upbringing and your environment. So I don't necessarily think that it's able to discern personalities. So
yeah. And there's a point here about whether, you know, is there something unknown about defending against airbending that takes down all adversaries, like Korra's takedown of Amon? Because the White Lotus are a pushover when Zaheer breaks out. It might just have been that they weren't prepared for him. It might have been that they were non-benders because he, you know, was a non-bender and all they had to do was shove some rice at him. But, you know, and the Air Nomad, more than any other nation, you know, they've been, you know, nasty earthbenders and firebenders and waterbenders. Obviously, we only known Aang and Tenz's family, and then glimpses of what the Air Nomads used to be like. But, you know, do you think that airbending is actually the most powerful fighting tool, maybe, and that that's the reason that they became so peaceful? Because, like, with great power becomes great responsibility or whatever. Like, Karen, how did you feel about that situation with airbending used for fighting, which is not intrinsically what it's about, as far as we know?
I was actually thinking about this quite a lot, because I was like, man, out of all the things for him to get, he got airbending, which, granted, I think firebending also would have allowed him to get off of that cliff that he was on, but airbending was kind of like the perfect thing for him to get. And his prison guards did have some powers, so I mean, he did have to go up against them and defeat, I think there were at least fire and earth there. But yeah, in terms of them being the most powerful, I don't know if anyone is the most powerful over the other. I mean, that's kind of the point, isn't it? Like, they all have their strengths and weaknesses, and one kind of counteracts the other, and they can all do special things that the other type of bending just isn't, like, capable of doing. So in terms of it being more powerful, maybe not, but I think for his situation, it was quite a lucky thing for him to get the airbending.
Yeah. Caitlin, how do you feel about the airbending going to, you know, an evil man, basically, or just, and how that ties into, I guess, the history of airbending and how there seems to be no evil ones?
I mean, I feel like there probably are evil airbenders throughout their history, but they probably banished them or something like that, and it's just not something that is talked about very much. Yeah, like, we're not going to talk about this because out of sight, out of mind or something. But I can't imagine that there were never any evil airbenders throughout history. They probably are maybe rare because the population was probably smaller than some of the other nations, but I'm sure that there were some.
Yeah, there's a lot of conversations to be had about what the hell was going on with the air nomad lifestyle in general, which we can talk about in the next episode. But any theories about who Zaheer is and what he did to deserve such a high security, like, solo prison? Karen is our newbie. Anything?
I don't know. I have some theories about the end of the next episode that I want to talk about once we get there, so I don't want to say too much. But I don't know what he did, but, I mean, if he was a non-bender and he was treated like that, that's kind of terrifying. But I already kind of love him and his gang because they seem like really bad dudes. But it's just like, you know how like Ariana loves Azula? I kind of feel that way toward this group, which is weird because usually I'm not like that. But I'm like so here to see what they're going to do.
And, like, you know, the fact that the White Lotus are keeping him prisoner, like, since when is that their job to keep people prisoner rather than a particular country? Like, you know, is he above the, you know, government of one particular country or something like that?
I mean, he must be a bad guy to be on this isolated rock in the middle of nowhere, kept in prison like he was. So, yeah, really interesting.
Yeah, it seems like a lot of manpower. Like, I don't really believe in the death penalty, but, you know, it might have been a lot cheaper than, you know, having him killed than it would have been to have a special prison and pay all these guards just to look after him. I suppose that's the argument people make for the death penalty in general. I still don't particularly agree with it, but interesting. You know, it's a children's cartoon. I can believe it in a children's cartoon. Let's go on to our favourite scenes and lines quickly. My favourite scene was the Korra and Asami car conversation because it was, you know, when they were talking about Marco, because I just found it delightful. So, Karen, what was yours?
When Bolin sort of like puts his hair like Mako's and pretends to be like him and calls him a brooding teenager.
Bolin's whole scene about like the family, like, you know, all of the kids in the all of the people in the family and how he liked being a part of it was delightful to me as well. So yeah. Caitlin, how about yours? Yours was the plot point that we didn't really talk through point by point of what happened with him. So do you want to talk about this?
Sure. So I chose the moment when Korra is talking Daw, the second airbender, the one that tears up the shop, down from the bridge, that he is clearly getting ready to commit suicide because he's afraid of hurting everybody. And she flies up and essentially talks him down from what he's going to do. And this was so powerful to me because it shows how much she has changed and how much she has grown. She realizes that she can't take kind of a forceful approach to the situation. So she's just like, hey, can I sit down? Like, I've had a really bad day too. Like, she just finesses it, which is so different for her. So it really shows how much she has changed and grown and is growing into a strong avatar and just a strong adult.
Yeah, this was very, like, Aang. Like, you can imagine the Korra in the past being, like, just grabbing him, being just like, get off the bridge, you stupid idiot! You know, like, so, yeah, I appreciate that. Donya, how about you for your favourite scene?
Mine was the entire dinner table scene after Bumi discovers he can airbend, especially the Bolin bit. That was my favourite scene.
Yeah. I do like when, Milo throws the plate. I'm glad that they didn't, like, totally dismiss Bumi. Like, they were kind of like, what is he talking about? But no one was like, no one really dragged him down being like, you're a crazy liar, Bumi, you just want attention. Like, there was a minute and a half of, like, before it was actually proven that he could do it, if you know what I mean. Like, I'm really glad that we didn't have too long of them hating on Bumi for, quote-unquote, making up that he could airbend. So that was nice. Yeah.
I do like the plate throwing.
favorite lines. Mine was actually the hedgehog spirit talking to Korra, saying, you know, when she was kind of like, you know, what are you doing? What do we do? You know, why are you living in the road and stuff like that? and is kind of when she's trying to clean up the city, and he's says, "Don't ask me, Avatar. You made the world this way. We're just living in it," which is true. Basically, you know, she's going around having, like, you know, why are the spirits messing everything up? And it's like, yeah, it's like, Korra, what did you expect to happen, kind of thing. And I was just, I don't know, I just found that very poignant. So yeah, just moving on, Karen.
I actually really loved the scene between Dawn, Korra too, and just everything that had to do with him was really, really funny. But when he's after he gets down off of the bridge and Tenzin is like, "It is absolutely my pleasure to meet you, Da. I've never met a new airbender before. Well, at least no one whose diaper I didn't have to change." And then Da goes, "Actually, I just fell off a bridge, so I could use a fresh diaper right about now." And it was hilarious, but it was also this callback to, like, the season one humor, because I used to laugh so much at this show and all of Avatar too. Like, and season two kind of didn't have that as much. Like, I found myself being frustrated more than anything. And now we're getting back to the humor, and I was laughing so hard throughout these two episodes. It's just really nice to return to that.
Yeah, there are a few really stunning, funny moments. Like, when Tenzin's, like, eyebrow raise after he says that, and also Tenzin, like, zooming out of frame when Marco and Asami are talking to Korra was hysterical to me.
Yeah, so, yeah. I did like that part, too, actually. And when one of the girls just yells, "Dad," and he, like, comes running, and he's like, "What?" And just his face, and, yeah, it was great.
I love him. All right. Quotes from Caitlin and Donya.
So mine was more Tenzin appreciation, but it was Tenzin channeling his inner Iroh. He was dropping some wisdom bombs. So he tells Korra, "True wisdom begins when we accept things as they are." And wisdom bomb.
Isn't that nice? And Donya, how about you?
Mine was from when Korra and Asami are talking in the car, and when Korra goes, "Well, whatever happened with Marco, I'm glad it hasn't come between us. I've never had a girlfriend to hang out with and talk to before, except for Naga. This is nice."
Naga is a dog, Korra. A dog.
That's a sad state about her social life.
Yeah.
Don't
she was
judge.
Isolated for the entire first part of her life. So.
Well, I mean, you mean it's sad. Like, I wasn't making fun.
Yeah, it's like, my only female friend is my dog. Yeah. Okay.
Sometimes anyway. Those are the only friends we have, guys.
Oh. Well, yeah. Okay, we're going to do the next episode now, Rebirth. In this episode, the crew fails to recruit any airbenders because ain't nobody got time for that. Tenzin is surprisingly hot. Mitch was really hung up on Tenzin being shirtless. And Korra and Asami team up against Marco, and it's beautiful. A newbie airbender named Kai likes to steal stuff like Jinora's heart. Meanwhile, Zaheer frees fellow convicts Gazan, an earthbender with chakram earth chunk heating abilities, and Minghua, an armless waterbender. With Zaheer's girlfriend left to be jailbroken, Mother Effin Zuko of the Fire Nation takes away on his dragon to stop them.
Yes!
So that happened.
Karen's so excited.
Okay, my first question, before we start anything else, because I actually find the airbender journey in this, like the airbender travels around the world in this really important. But first of all, just about Zuko quickly. Did you know he was alive at all? I can't remember if they, because if Iroh was like my mother and grandfather at some point, like he mentions them existing, if you know what I mean, and I can't remember if that was like.
I will say that I never knew for certain. I think that. Between our conversations, I had sort of gleaned that maybe it was a possibility that people were kind of being like, "Well, we don't know who's dead and who's alive." And I was like, kind of holding on to hope, but it was a huge shock to me because I was like, "Oh my God, is that really him? Is that really him?" And it was.
Before the series came out, they gave a whole bunch of information about certain characters, and there was something about Zuko. So those of us who were watching when Korra started and were following before it had started got information that Zuko was alive and he was traveling the world as like a motivational speaker about peace.
Yeah,
and...
that he was kind of retired from being the Fire Lord, but that he sort of still is the Fire Lord because, you know, but yeah, that he is a... Yeah, he's basically, like, doing Aang... It's interesting because it's kind of like he was doing Aang's job for him in the time when there was no Avatar, or, like, when the time when, like, the Avatar was a child and not doing Avatar duties. So, yeah, like, motivational speaker, like, doling out wisdom, basically. So, yeah, on his dragon.
Zuko has a dragon, you guys.
I love his dragon. It's so great.
All right. We'll hold on to all of that for a moment. So, because first of all, I want to talk about the great airbender hunt in which Tenzin is disappointed over and over again. So basically, they're going on a journey around the world. They have their airship, their plane, or their bus, or whatever it is, their blimp that Asami gives them, which is, you know, better than traveling on the back of their bison. So that's fun. And yeah, so the younger kids are staying at home on Airbender Island with, you know, Pema and Kaya, and, you know, Team Avatar, including all of the four teenagers, they managed to convince Marco to come. Tenzin and Jinora are traveling around the world, you know, where they've heard of Airbenders coming into the world, new adults with powers. And Tenzin is going around trying to recruit them to come to the air temple, the Northern Air Temple, and rebuild the air nomad way of life. And it doesn't go very well. And I feel sad for him, but I also have a lot of questions about whether what he's doing is right or not. So he's going around knocking on the door, being like, come, basically being like, come, hey, join my religion. Like, it's a bit like, hello, my name is Elder Tenzin. You know, I'd like to, you know, tell you all about this amazing book, you know, like, it's true.
Oh, the tune is going through my head the whole
yeah,
time.
Yeah, sorry.
I wonder if he leaves little pamphlets at their doors.
Yeah, like, it's, he's basically knocking on doors, trying to convert people to his religion because they have his power, because he sees the airbending, you know, as a reemergence of a culture and a race, basically, when it's not. It's people from all over the world who have just happened to develop this skill. So the big, you know, I feel really bad for him, but the big question is whether what he's doing is actually right, or if he is sort of deluded about what it means that there are new airbenders. So, Caitlin, first off, how do you feel about that divide, you know, between airbending the skill and air, kind of the air nomad culture?
I think for just thinking about in terms of the way Tenzin would be thinking about it, it's completely unprecedented for them to be separate things.
Yes.
Because, like, there's just never been a situation where that would be in question, like, no matter basically which nation you're coming from, there's just no reason for it to be anything separate. So I completely understand why his assumption is, oh, you have airbending, now you must become an air nomad, because that's what you do if you have airbending. So, but it, you would hope he would start thinking after he gets those first rejections that maybe this is not my best approach and I should contemplate whether to continue this way. But when he starts off that way, I think it makes total sense for him to do that.
Yeah, I agree. Like, it is unprecedented. But in, you know, it and I get that he'd be, you know, he can't imagine how someone wouldn't be totally excited by it. But yeah, Karen, you know, as a newbie kind of witnessing his failure, how did you feel about it?
Really conflicted. I definitely agree that there's no precedent for it. I also think that he kind of went about it the wrong way because he was so zealous about it that I think he definitely scared some people away. But at the same time, I kind of viewed it as like you're telling your friend about this really awesome television show that you're just like, guys, you gotta watch this. Like, it's the most amazing thing in the entire world. And you love it so much. And they're like, yeah, not really my thing. Not super interested in that. And you're just like, no, but you have to watch it. And you end up like driving them away because of it. So I don't think it was like converting them to a religion that they weren't necessarily like into. It was more just like they didn't feel the need to connect with this ancient culture that they've obviously lived their whole lives without. And so, yeah, they probably want to learn how to use their airbending powers, but they don't feel like the rest of it is absolutely necessary.
Yeah, like, I mean, it is basically, you know, yeah, it is the separation of, like, the skill of airbending. Like, hey, I'm a person from the Earth Nation. I live here. I run a farm. And now I have this skill. Does this mean I have a responsibility to change my entire life in order to, you know, because I have this skill to make the culture that this skill originally came from? And it is sort of a tough call to make because on one hand, you know, you understand that, like, it's kind of like an endangered species. It's like, say a tiger was, like, conscious, you know, say a tiger was, like, sentient, and you were like, hey, tiger, I need you to stay in this zoo so that you don't die because you are an endangered species. And the tiger's like, but I want to, like, run around India, and if someone shoots me, no big deal, if you know what I mean. Like, that's sort of what we're looking at here, basically. The airbenders are like an endangered species. And, yeah, and it's whether it's fair to kind of control them for the sake of saving them, I guess. No, Donya, how did you take this?
I mean, the way that I looked at it as well is the burden of carrying on the culture of the air nomads is solely on Tenzin's shoulders. Mm-hmm. And I think for him having, I guess, more people who could potentially come and help him uphold that culture, who are older and able to kind of help him guide other people, you know, that probably drove him a little bit as well, because he's been alone in it other than Aang and his own children. Like, that's it.
I mean, he has air acolytes. He has all of these non-benders who are, yeah, like, monks and stuff, like, oh, who want to be in the Air Nation. And he's kind of not, you know, he's not taking them into consideration that much, because there is, you don't see them that much in the show, but there is a massive history of these people who want to be air nomads, you know, whether they can bend or not, and maybe some of them got powers, but I don't know.
Maybe we've yet to encounter.
Anyway, so he basically, they're all terrible sales reps. We had a few people, you know, and he obviously said the wrong thing to the wrong person every single time. But we have a couple of longer interactions, one with the farmer. Who, you know, he's like, everyone's like, leave your family, and the kids are like, daddy, don't go. And then one with the emo teenager in the basement, which was the mom of the emo teenager, is like one of the best things in this entire show. It's great. But yeah, I don't know. I guess just his reaction was really interesting to me, because, you know, that's when Korra kind of goes in and has a go as well, and becomes incredibly frustrated at his, you know, apathy. But he also raises the point that, you know, she's like, I didn't ask to be the Avatar, but I'm doing my duties. And he's kind of like, you don't have to. You literally don't have to, which I kind of agree with. I'm kind of like, yeah, in a modern society, would the Avatar die out? You know, like, would if you had all of, you know, the people with that kind of attitude, or, you know, people who just, you know, want to make their own way, would you kind of get people who are like, yeah, just because I have this thing doesn't mean I have to be held back by it or stick to it? I mean, not that anyone would call it being the Avatar being held back, but, you know, it's kind of like, I don't know, it would be kind of like, stepping down from the throne. Like, what's that called? Abdicating. Like, do you think you can abdicate being the Avatar?
This was actually something I was wondering about during the episode. I was like, what if she decided she didn't want to? Like, would the next Avatar take over? How does that work exactly?
No, she'd have to die.
That would suck then, for the world to be without an Avatar, but also, like, not being able to move on to the next one.
Yeah.
I imagine it's also related to upbringing, because the White Lotus found Korra when she was so young, so they were able to raise her in a way that pushed her to always accept that she was going to have to take on her duties, whereas if it was somebody who grew up without that sort of motivation, it might be different. But if you're still finding them when they're very young, you can kind of mold them to take on those duties as they get older.
Yeah, I don't know, just if in today's society, I wonder, you know, what it would be like if there was an avatar in the world right now, and if they were like, no. But anyway, what approach, I guess, would have, sorry, this whole subject is very interesting to me, the whole, trying to recreate the air nomads and what responsibility those airbenders have to that, you know. What approach would you guys taken, or what, I mean, obviously they're going to have to come up with a solution at the end of the day, at some point. That seems to be the plot of the entire season. But at this point, I guess, Karen, I'll ask, what approach would you take to solving this problem, and what, you know, what responsibility do you actually think that the new airbenders have, slash what responsibility do you think Tenzin has, to making the air culture again with the new airbenders?
Well, I don't think that they can force anybody to come with them and learn about the culture and everything. And perhaps the people who do have these newfound powers will find a way to master them and, be able to sort of lead their life as airbenders without having to be a part of Tenzin's religion. But I think that if they just continue to go around asking people, there are going to be people who are into the idea. So I think that's really the best that they can do.
Yeah. Do you think Tenzin's going to have to take the hit and accept that, like, being an airbender isn't, and being an air nomad, like, you know, and that his skills are, you know, that airbending is actually a skill and not a religion?
Yeah, I would say that.
Mm. Okay, so they kind of have they have the brilliant idea to kind of try selling airbending to the world by changing their sales pitch, by coming in to town like a big carnival and putting on an airbending show in which they, you know, take down a firebending criminal and all of that kind of nonsense. So this moment was one of the most ridiculous that The Legend of Korra has had so far. Like, this is throwing right back to Atla ridiculousness at points. So yeah, the performance, the street performance of airbending, Donya, how did you feel?
I love this entire thing. It's so ridiculous, it's so over the top, and it's so Avatar that I absolutely love it. But now that you've made the Book of Mormon comparison, all I'm thinking is, like, the way that they kind of make the plot of Star Wars the plot of the book versus them.
Yeah, is this, like, the all-American prophet moment of Legend of Korra? Because,
it is now, basically, since you've made that comparison, it has now taken on a whole new meaning for me. So I kind of enjoy this scene even more in my head, so...
Yeah. The best thing is obviously Criminal Marco and Asami and Korra laughing at him as well. So that was great. Mitch has noted that Tenzin is shirtless, which is true. Was that important for anyone else? Because it seems to be very important for Mitch.
Yes, I actually found that quite important because he was super hot and I was not ready for that.
All right. The man with the arrow tattoo pointing to his nose. Okay. One of the people. They do successfully recruit a new airbender, a child called Kai, who sells them this sob story about being recently orphaned. And he's like, let's leave town right now. I want to come with you. Which is... Aladdin Part 2, Street Rat, Scoundrel, etc. after Juan. And it turns out that he's actually a lifelong orphan who was adopted recently by a good family, and he robbed them and is a terrible human being, basically. So, I mean, he's 12, so he's got time. But, yeah, did you believe Kai's fake story at first, Karen, about his tragic life and how he needs to leave town right now?
I really, really wanted to, and I think I kind of, like, tricked myself into believing it.
Karen.
But there was, like, this nagging feeling in the back of my mind, like, this is just too good to be true. I think something else is up, and it was.
Yes. So the police come after him, basically, and apparently start attacking without announcing that they're police and that they're the group. Fights them, and the group, you know, believes that they are the bandits that, you know, killed Kai's family. And then it turns out that they're actually the cops, and they make an agreement to, you know, give the stuff Kai stole back, but they get to keep Kai and not take him to prison. So do you think that taking him on was a good thing or a bad thing? Do you think they should have just let him go to prison, Caitlin, or do you think that it's good that he is with them now?
I think it's probably for the best, because then they can keep an eye on him, like, both for his attitude and the fact that he's a new airbender, because if you take him off to prison, who knows what he's going to do and where he could end up. This way they at least have a shot at keeping him under control.
True. And yeah, I mean, do you, I don't want to say, do you think we're going to be seeing a lot of him to the super fans? Karen, you've got too much responsibility. Karen, do you think that we're going to be seeing a lot of Kai, or do you think that he's going to, you know, do something dodgy and leave at some point?
I think he's going to be important. I feel like they definitely focused on him. I mean, he's really the first and the only one that they've picked up after this whole thing that they decide to do, going around door to door, basically, and trying to find new airbenders. So, yeah, I think he's going to be important. I'm really glad that Korra decided to take him on, despite him being sort of a dodgy character right now. I think that perhaps, I guess what I should say is, I'm hoping that he becomes one of those people who's, like, intensely loyal to the crew because they took him in when nobody else thought he was good enough, and he's just going to end up being, like, this awesome guy.
That's a good point. And when he walked up the gangway and he was like, I've made a change, that was the old me, airbending has changed me, did you believe that? Or do you think he's just trying to, like, do you believe that he was a criminal and that he wants to get away because he feels differently now? Or do you think that it was just a cover-up?
I don't know. I mean, all the other people that we ran into, it doesn't really seem like it's changed them. Like, the super lazy guy, he was like, yeah, I really don't care. Like, that didn't change him at all. Although, I would like to say that maybe it was, like, a half-truth. Like, maybe he feels like he has more potential now, and that's kind of giving him more confidence to start over, which would be really nice.
Yeah. Well, we'll keep our fingers crossed. And he seems to have impressed Jenora pretty quickly. So do you think that she might be getting into a little bit of trouble there, flying around on the ship with this hot kid?
It was really cute. I don't know. She's got a good head on her shoulders. I hope she doesn't change who she is because of a boy.
I mean, she's pretty young. Do you think that this is like that there will be a proper romance for her, you know, in the show? I mean, how old is she compared to the romance in Atla, I suppose?
Yeah. Isn't she about the same age as Aang was? Or is she a little younger?
10 in book 1, 11 in books 2 and 3.
Where were we? Jenora, Kai, etc. Marco still being awkward around Korra and Asami, and Mitch can't get enough. Lay in the ditch, you dug yourself, asshat. And then Ariana says, Mitchell, stop, he's fine. So Mitch seems really hung up on Marco's problems. He's not very forgiving, is he, Mitch, of Marco's...
Mitch is hung up on a lot of things.
...past errors. So, yeah, I love Marco being, like, super awkward and great and, you know, forced to participate as the evil firebending criminal. I loved it, so, yeah. And Bolin's mustache, obviously. So Marco and Bolin with Kai should be interesting, basically. Like, Bolin being like, you're going to be my little brother. And Marco's like, I've been the crafty street rat trying to get ahead, and I know that you're a bad kid and I'm going to watch you. So the boys with Kai should be quite interesting as well. Zahir. So going on to the final point, which is Zahir's rounding up his gang and Zuko getting wind of it. I know this is what Karen really wants to talk about. So a few things. The first, Zahir goes around the world to all of these special prisons that have been made specifically to keep certain people. Like for example, Gazan, who is an earthbender, he is on a wooden ship in the middle of the ocean, so no earth, no metal in water. And Zahir goes in and manages to toss him some rocks, and Zahir manages to heat up the rocks and make some really a really cool escape, which how did you guys react to this the first time you saw it? I guess Donya, Caitlin, and Karen. This I'm a big one for like adapting all the bending. I'm like, stop being so basic with your bending. Stop just throwing rocks. Like, figure out science and figure out how to do more intricate things with a base element. So we've got this situation here, which is really, really, really cool that I really liked. So yeah, how did you guys react to this first unusual bender in Zahir's gang? Donya, how did you take him?
I really loved it. Like, I thought it was so interesting that he was doing something different with his bending, because like you said, everyone else kind of tends to do the same thing over and over and over and over again. It's very basic skills. They just kind of learn what they need to and then not much else. They don't really experiment with how far that could go. You know, obviously one of the exceptions would be Toph and how she kind of adapted her bending to be able to bend metal. So I thought it was really, really cool that we're seeing someone who, yeah, okay, fine, he's the bad guy, but he's doing something interesting. And he's taking some initiative with trying to do something different.
Yeah, I mean, and it always seems to be the bad guys that have the, the specialty skills. Like, you know, the unusual benders always seem to be the ones who have specialty, you know, they end up kind of bad. And so that kind of says something maybe about, like, conformity and, like, being outcast for being weirdly creative. Anyway, I'm into it. It's better than bloodbending to start with. And, you know, did it kind of make you, you know, open your mind about earthbending and what could be possible with earthbending?
Yeah, I was really confused. I was like, wait, didn't he toss him, like, a couple of rocks? Why is there fire?
Fire plus rock equals.
Yeah, I get it now, and I think that it's pretty cool, and I would love to see more ways for them to do stuff like this.
Yeah. I really appreciate it. And then the second bender is maybe even more interesting. It's a female waterbender who basically, so Gazan, that's the earthbender, and Zahir go and they break out the next member of their gang, who was again in a solo prison above a volcano where she could have no water. And she's got no arms, and they throw her some water barrels. And she busts them open, creates the arms that she uses, the water arms that she uses when she has access to water, and manages to bust out of the gang as well. And her name is Minghua. And so, first of all, a bunch of questions here. How did she lose her arms? And then the Others would like to know, couldn't she have just water bent like people, or spit, or sweat, or people? So perhaps she does not have the capacity to blood bend, or perhaps she needs to do stuff with kind of physical, quote unquote, like physical hands, like that she needs the arms in order to do the movements to bend. Caitlin, Minghua and her introduction, the first time you saw this, how did you feel about that entire situation?
My God, my mind was blown. Like,
yeah, me too.
She is set, like, this character is so different than anything we have seen. We have not seen a character using bending in this way, like, to be limbs, functional limbs. Like, that's freaking crazy. So you're looking for your out-of-the-box bending. There's your out-of-the-box bending. And it really shows both of these breakouts, like, why all these people were in these creative one-person White Lotus prisons. Like, they are hella dangerous.
Yeah, really, really bad. And this character, you know, when she speaks to Zahir saying, you know, I'm, you know, grateful that you got me out before you, you know, you're that girlfriend of yours. So, you know, and number one, how bad is the girlfriend? And number two, Karen, did you recognize her voice?
The, of who?
Minghua, the waterbender.
No, I did not.
This character is also voiced by Grey Delisle, who voiced Azula. So your evil ladies, they've got, you know, she's got them down, basically. Nice. And, yeah, so that's this character. I think this information was just released in a Q&A, and it's not actually that important to the show. Her lack of arms is from birth, basically. So it's congenital. It's not, it's, they weren't hacked off in an accident or something like that, or a fight. So it is something that, so she would have been born like this, according to Brian and Mike in a Q&A, and she would have learnt to bend, you know, develop these skills. You know, God knows if there was anyone to teach this kind of specific stuff, or if she sort of just developed it herself, basically. She was born with that. So, yeah, it is a really interesting character, really, really interesting idea to include. What she might get up to, and you know, how this gang was formed, like the earthbender, you know, the hot earthbender, the this armless waterbender, and then Zahir, who's a non-bender. Presumably Zahir's girlfriend, whoever she is, when they bust her out, is also going to have some super sick, crazy, unusual powers. And do you think that, you know, any theories about, like, what Zahir can do if, you know, he's a non-bender, and why all these, like, super cool specialty benders, you know, decided to hang out with him and follow him, basically? Karen, any theories there about what Zahir can do? You said at the end of, you know, you had some stuff about this episode from the last episode.
Yeah, I mean, I just think that these guys are, like, so cool, like, super scary, but also really cool, and I'm definitely here to see them be the bad guys. I don't know. I mean, the only thing I could think was he's super smart or something like that, because they said that he was their leader, and the fact that he was without any bending means that he definitely has something else up his sleeves. So maybe it's just that he's a really good strategist or had a lot of connections or something. Maybe he, like, took them all under his wings and taught them stuff, and they're just loyal to him. I don't know, but I'm definitely here to find out.
Yeah. And then the reports of those criminals, you know, some government somewhere gets wind of them and, you know, explains the situation to Zuko, basically. So Zuko, you know, gets wind of this. And he, you know, he says, I know where they're going. He, you know, he sends note to the Northern Water Tribe, the new chiefs of the Northern Water Tribe. So that's new chiefs, plural. So that's Desna and Eska hanging out in the Northern Water Tribe, being the Chiefs, so that must be fun for everyone there, that there's going to be an attack on their high security prison. So if we're thinking about Northern Water Tribe, you know, they must be keeping another person in a solo prison, like four corners of the globe, specialty prisons. Presumably we can, you know, safely assume we've got one earth, one water, one non-bender who's now an airbender, and presumably the last one, you know, by process of elimination, we're going to say, is a specialty firebender being kept in a water prison. Zuko knows this and is going to ride off on his sexy dragon to stop, he feels like it's his responsibility, even though he's like 100 years old, to stop these people. So it must have been a big crime that happened under his reign or something he was involved with potentially. But he feels a personal responsibility to stop this situation that he seems to know a lot about. So, yeah, your mind was blown by the appearance of Zuko to handle this situation, Karen?
I'm pretty sure I was shaking afterwards. Like, legit. I was so excited. It was amazing. And just the whole ending. You know, these whole first two episodes were so good. And I'm so excited to keep watching.
Sorry. Yeah, it is a lot of fun. So how do we feel? I guess thoughts, feelings about seeing Zuko again, like Caitlin and Donya, when you first watched, obviously, you knew, or you may have known, that he was kind of not necessarily gonna be there, but you know, that he might be around at some point. How do you feel about like how he looks, how he sounds, everything about him as an old man, basically? Caitlin, how did you feel about him? Do you love it? Do you have any issues with it?
Love. I love Zuko. I love seeing him. I love that he's still so clearly involved in things that are going on. And perhaps what stuck out to me most, besides the fact that he has a freaking dragon, was that he was like, send word to Beifong that Avatar must be protected. I'm like, wow, you have changed so much.
Oh, it's so cute. I have a tiny issue with his voice actor. I know that Dante Basco as the young Zuko has a very unique voice, but I think they possibly could have got someone to represent his voice, like his voice having aged slightly better, like just something about the tone or something about the speed. You know, people change, but like there's something about it that I can't quite equate with Zuko about the voice acting, but I do.
Yeah, I agree.
Regardless, and you do get used to it.
There was this like detachment for me, and I kept having to stare at him, be like, is that really Zuko? Is it really Zuko? Because it kind of took me out of it, to be honest. And maybe it's because like his voice is so recognizable, but I think you're right that they could have maybe
It's not that I think they necessarily needed the same, like, you know, teenage voice, but the adapting of his very specific voice to old age voice, I think, could have been better, which is a little bit disappointing, but never mind. So he's still there, and he's got a dragon, and he's alive, and he's great, so that's all good. Donya, Zuko feelings.
So many Zuko feelings, so many. I remember like being ridiculously excited the first time I saw him. Like, I just like, until you see someone again, you're like, you don't realize how much you miss them. That was the kind of feeling that I got, and I was just so so happy to see him, and he had a dragon. I love his dragon, and that he's like there to take names and kick ass still. So.
Yeah, he's a bit good. I love him. So I guess that we can expect to see a little more Zuko coming up, given that he's chasing these four major criminals. And you know, do we expect to see anyone else from the old crew, like anyone else who remained in Aang, you know, who kept living after Aang died, that we met in the first generation of Atla, like, you know, or, you know, we've been asked to comment on, you know, when will we see Zutara now that Aang's long dead? a reunion between Katara and Zuko, because they're both alive and hanging out, and Aang has been dead for like 20 years. So, I mean, obviously Caitlin and I are not really here for that, but Karen, you're caught up in the hype, so were you disappointed that you didn't get to see him interact with any of the other old characters, or even like Tenzin or something like that?
No, I'm just happy that he's there. I mean, that's really all that I need. But, I mean, going forward, it would be cool to see what his relationship is like with some of the others. Especially, like, okay, Zutara aside, because, yes, I'm here for Zutara. But I would actually really like to see him interacting with Tenzin. I think that would be really interesting.
Yeah. Yes, we'll leave it at that. You know, because obviously saying either way would be a bit spoilery, but you know, I would love to you know, have him hanging out with everyone as well, and you know, getting the old group back together and just learning everything about what his relationships were like growing up, like, you know, Tenzin, Bumi and Kaya, like whether he knew them you know, well, like how often they hung out. Like Zuko and Aang are like literally BFFs, and I ship them more than I've ever shipped Zutara, so whatever. And and yeah, I don't know, just all of that history, you know, of what it was like, you know, being adults with the original Atla crew. So yeah, so favorite scenes. Mine was the traveling by map door-to-door montage of them recruiting the airbenders, and how the little cartoon faces got sadder and sadder on the little boat traveling across the map as they kept failing. So I adored that bit of animation and humor. I thought it was great. And now you guys can all talk about Zuko.
Yeah, I have to pass because I wasn't going to pick another one. Like, that was it for me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Danya got to Zuko. The dock first.
Yeah, Danya. Yeah.
She came in and put this. Can I just say, I came in and did my quotes about eight or 10 hours ago, like before I went to bed last night. And she hadn't put quotes for anything else. She just put the favorite scene for the second episode. She hadn't actually done her job. It's not like she got in early and did all of her bits. She just came and did this. Though I will say that I'm already putting in a request / if anyone else does it, I have a quote from our next show, from an episode for our next show,
Dad.
Which if anyone takes it, I will literally burn the house down and quit the show. Like, I will put a request in immediately as soon as it is announced, being like, if anyone takes this, because it's the most, I can't say anything more.
I know exactly what line you're talking about.
Do you?
Yeah, I think so.
Oh my God, message me. Okay. Favorite lines from the episode. Oh, sorry, Caitlin, you didn't get to do your Zuko answer because Donya came in and stole it, basically. Yes.
So I picked another one.
Yes.
And I chose their street performance with everything and Mako's like deadpan, I'm the escaped criminal, and being like, this isn't what we rehearsed, when Asami and Korra laughing at him, and just everything was amazing and hilarious. And if I couldn't choose Zuko, I was gonna choose that one.
Fair enough. And Donya,
so I feel like I need to defend myself a little bit, because I came into the dark with...
If you're gonna come in early and steal something, you should at least do your job and fill in all four of your segments, not just one.
Yes. So I came into the dock to do exactly that, but my parents are down visiting this weekend. They are actually over my cousin's house right now, because I said, oh, you can't stay with me because I have to record an episode tonight of a podcast. So you can't be here. You have to stay with my cousin about 5 minutes away. But they came literally as I was coming into the dock to fill it out. So I got that far, and then I had to entertain them until I got back to the dock a little bit later. So, yeah. My parents were inconvenient today.
Fine.
They have interrupted an episode before when we've actually been recording, I will say.
Fine. All right. My favorite quote was actually in the beginning, or when they're having the conversation about convincing her, they're having the conversation about convincing Marco to come with them. First of all, Bolin's entire, like, grandma crying scene, but mainly his, when he was like, you know, Bolin's like, I don't want to live, you know, I can't, you know, come with you. I have a life. And Bolin just says, a life? You sleep under your desk, which I found hilarious because just Marco is just pathetic. And I just loved it. So, yeah, it was great. Karen.
Mine was when Bolin's talking about his grandmother I'm not even sure he knows he has. And then he's like crying and being like this old lady. And then he just goes, and then she dies. I'm like, and oh my God.
That's what convinces Marco to come with him. Like, as well. Like, that's like, oh, fine, okay. Just in case grandma dies, I'll come. No. But yeah. Caitlin, what was your favorite?
So mine was before they do their street performance, they're coming up with the ideas, and you have the two characters that really don't need to be encouraging each other. You've got Boomy being like, well, maybe you got to do more than get them excited. You need to add a little razzle-dazzle. And Bolin's like, yeah, razzle-dazzle. We could put on some sort of airbending street performance. To which Boomy replies, I was going to say we could cover Tenzin's robe and sequins, but that's even better.
No. I expected him to have sequins, but then he just, like, ripped everything off, and I was like, okay, that works too.
Oh, God.
Magic Mike.
Yeah. Shit. No. Okay. Donya.
Yes, so mine is from the actual street performance when Marco comes in and he goes all deadpan and he's like, I am the escaped convict and you will all reap my fire.
Oh dear. All right. Well, that's everything from the episode. We're going to go through some feedback now before Karen stops. But if you want to reach us to get in touch with us about the upcoming book 3 of Legend of Korra, you can email us on rewatchable.podcast@gmail.com. You can tweet re_watchable, comment on this post on hyperball.com, or join us on Tumblr, rewatchablepodcast.tumblr.com, for all your fantastic GIF needs. You can also rate us on iTunes so that we feel like a legit podcast. If you rate us 5 stars, then Karen will let you live in her basement in peace until you feel comfortable to go out into the brass and bold spiriting world. So I hope that you're ready to offer up your basement, Karen, to a lot of people out there who don't want to live in the world.
I mean, I don't have a basement. You can live under the house.
Get your earthbending out and just, you know, make one. So, okay. Oh, yeah. All right, going through a few tweets here. First one is from, we'll just go down the list in order of our quotes in order to read these out. First one, Gordon Toonie Chopper Man says, I swear if Mitch Cloud did the doc and skips Tenzin again, we riot. Tenzin is everything in this episode. # he is Tenzin. Also, I'd like to welcome the newbies to a heavily recurring theme throughout the rest of the show. Oh God, I can never say this pronoun. Is it Deus Ex? Like, is that the correct Latin pronunciation of that? Like as in Deus Ex Machina, but I don't know if I'm mangling it. Deus Ex Genora. So there's a little bit of a clue for you guys going ahead. This is in reference to last week. There was a lot of tens and that we wanted to talk about. But yeah, and Genora. So a recurring theme is Genora weirdly solving problems. So that's something for you guys to muse on for the future. Actually, I'll give Donya the next tweet if you want to read that one out.
Yes. So Shelley says, I'm so happy that Rewatchable brought up Downton Abbey and Tamora appears in the same episode. And I'm just so mad that I missed an episode where we were talking about Downton Abbey. What the hell?
Guys? That was last week. Ariana and I were just getting very excited at the end about Downton Abbey because someone said that we should do it as the next show. And we were like, that's not going to happen. But we screamed. Can you imagine Ariana's recaps? Like, can you imagine Ariana's synopsis for Downton Abbey? Because I would just die. But we were just screaming about Mary and Tom, basically.
Oh, my God.
All right. Karen, I don't even know what Amazon Prime is, so do you want to explain this?
Sure. Gleek Forever 22 said, oh, and just so you guys know, if you have Amazon Prime, Book 3 is on Prime now. Basically, it's like you can get it for free if you have a Prime account. I believe if it works that way for this one specifically, but it's just a way to watch the show. So that is excellent to know.
Okay, cool. Melanie Jo Needs, which is Ginny's hex, says, looking forward to listening to Korra season 3 as a newbie. Season 1 and 2 I'd watched prior, which is interesting. I'm wondering if there's anyone else that sort of gave up after book 2 and then picked it up again later, because I did for a long time. I didn't watch season 3 and 4 immediately. It was actually, or season 3 at least, like there was a big gap for me because I didn't like the end of season 2 very much. But I'm curious to see if there's anyone else who gave up partway through the show who's carrying on with season 3 and 4 now. And then, Caitlin, do you want to do this last one?
Sure. So Jen says, listen to old rewatchable eps. Funny how in VMARS, Mitch was the spoiler police, and during Atla, he was a walking spoiler ball. Agreed. That is hilarious.
Are there any, was he a newbie on VMARS? Like, he didn't want spoilers? Oh, well, I suppose. Yeah, that's true. So yeah, it's easy to be, you know, it's very, you know, easy to talk the talk, isn't it? But it ain't so easy to walk the walk, Mitch. So, a couple of hyperbole comments quickly. One saying from John Ricasa saying, am I the only one who thinks it would be fun if the group would hate watch the Shyamalan travesty that was The Last Airbender and then do a podcast on it? I won't lie. It makes me kind of mad just thinking about that movie and the comments that Shyamalan made in defending his movie. But I think it'll be very interesting to see what some of the newbies would say if they see it. Just a thought. Did we not do this?
We did do this. It's at the end of our Avatar The Last Airbender run. And some of us did talk about it. There was definitely lots of disappointment, so I don't think you will be disappointed in listening to it.
Yeah.
And none of the super fans wanted to waste their time.
Yeah, I said Danya, right?
I just rewatched it. Okay? I had to rewatch it, and I had
to host. You volunteered. Don't be like that.
It. I actually ended up having to watch it at work.
They're adults. They can host their own episode. Like, they don't need you. Like, you know.
When I was watching part of the episode, I was watching it at work as well, and some of the people were walking past me and going, why are you watching that? And I was, like, podcasting about it.
Okay, TARDIS77 said, I think you need to rewatch the season finale again because it was the Southern Water Tribe elders that appointed Korra's dad chiefs, not Korra. In the Southern Water Tribe, the chieftain is not passed down in families. Katara and Sokka were not a prince or princess. But we were talking about Korra being the Water Tribe princess and her dad being... Yes, so this is right. Basically, last episode, someone mentioned, was it fair that Korra, you know, made her dad the chief? And it wasn't Korra that made her dad the chief, which I did say, but some of the others got sort of caught up in. It was like she said that the council appointed him. But we were talking about Korra being the Water Tribe princess because her dad used to be the ruler of the Northern Water Tribe. Like, he was meant to be the heir of the Northern Water Tribe. But if the and then we were wondering if her dad was becoming the ruler of both tribes, which is not correct. What's happened with the Water Tribes is two tribes. Allies, separate rulers. It used to be that there was like a leader of the Southern Tribe, but that the royal family, like the chief royal family, like the UA came from, was in the North, and they also owned the South. Like, the South was a colony of the North. Now they're separate. Korra's dad is the chief of the South, but he used to be the heir to the chief of the North. So if he hadn't got banished, Korra would be the UA-style princess of the North, which we are very glad that she is not, basically. So any other questions about Water Tribe rulership, you may leave them, I suppose, but that's all there is to it, I think. And Desna and Eska are now the chiefs of the Northern Water Tribe. Email from Jennifer and Saley. Okay, Caitlin, do you want to read the first one? Oh, no, hang on. This one, Karen, you read the first one. Caitlin, you read the second one.
Okay. Jennifer says, I binge listened to your Atla and Cora podcast so I could catch up, and finally I made it. Just wanted to say how much I love your podcasts and listening to your lovely voices. Special shout out to Karen and Natalie, since I began my journey into the Hypo podcast through NATWP. Woo! The first time I saw Legend of Cora, I must admit I wasn't the biggest fan, but now that I am rewatching it with you guys, I'm enjoying it more. By the way, I know you still have a while to go until you consider new shows to rewatch, but I'm just going to throw out Roswell and Kyle XY. We always take new show ideas. We've got some already planned, but we have a huge list and we continually add to it, even if I haven't written them down yet, which I haven't in a while. But yes, there are always possibilities. So feel free to keep pitching them to us. Also, thank you for listening to Another Teen Wolf podcast. Nat and I appreciate that.
Yeah, I guess. I guess we do. Thanks. Thanks. Or something. Teen Wolf, wow. Throwback. That happened a long time ago. Anyway. Sorry. And then, Caitlin, do you want to read the second one from Saley here?
Right, so Saley says, OMG, OMG, OMG. Ever since I heard Rewatchable was doing Atla, I've been waiting for this moment. Book 3 is perhaps my favorite book / season of the entire franchise. There are certain things that happen that leave me breathless and others that completely blow my mind. I can't wait for you to continue watching the series and its awesomeness. P.S. You make my commute to school on Mondays much easier. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Saley. Caitlin, do you like book 3 better than book 4, or what one? How do you feel about the end of the series?
I think book 3 slightly edges out book 4 for me.
Yeah, it's real good. So yeah,
they're both really great though.
Yeah.
Just say that.
So get excited, everyone. And I'm excited to hear, you know, how our other newbies have felt about entering into Atla, entering into Cora Book 3. But you'll hear from them next week, hopefully. So until then, I am Natalie.
I'm Karen.
I'm Caitlin.
And I'm Danya.
Thank you guys for listening to us. So bye-bye.
Bye.
Playing Pokemon Shuffle. This game is really addictive.
Still.
Yeah. Really freaking addictive. I can't catch the Slowpoke. It's really frustrating me.
Should we just talk about the irony of that sentence?
What?
You can't catch the Slowpoke?
Yes, okay. Thanks.
Now,
I've got like a 50% chance that I can catch this Pokemon. Oh, he spit the freaking Pokeball again. Okay, I'm done.
I am there, and my care for Pokemon is at a zero right now. So, I mean, to be fair, it's nearly always at, like, I'd say my care for Pokemon might have peaked at like a 0.75 in like 1999. But like, aside from that, no. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Rewatchable. We are on episode 124 for us, starting The Legend of Korra, Book 3, Change, and we're up to episodes 1, A Breath of Freth. This is gonna be good.
Promising start.
I'm gonna just start that whole thing again.